Well, I want to start by telling you about the time that I spent all my money on tickets to go see Dave Matthews Band. When I was in Bible college, my friend Mike had bought a ticket and he really wanted someone to go with him. And they were playing at the Gorge outside of Seattle, a big, massive outdoor arena. And he was really trying to convince me to go, and so I decided, you know what, yeah, let's do this, let's do it. So I drained my bank account on a ticket and I went with Mike to go to the concert. Now, we had thought that, hey, we're young, we can do this whole thing without stopping. We'll drive down there, we'll go to the concert, and then we'll drive back. Well, we hadn't really come to terms with our mortality at this point. We went to the concert. It was a great concert. They did two different encores. But when the concert had finished around 1 a.m. in the morning or whatever it was, we quickly realized that we had been a little overambitious. We did not have the metaphorical gas in the tank to do a return trip. And so we found the closest hotel, which for the sake of the story, we'll call the Axe Murderer Inn. And we got ourselves a room. And our non-smoking, just to kind of give you a glimpse of this hotel, our non-smoking room sounded like the maid who had, you know, cleaned the room before us had just lit up a cigarette and smoked it just before we got in there. So this is the kind of establishment we're talking about here. And when I woke up the following morning, my head was just pounding and aching. I had a severe caffeine headache. I think I had a headache from the secondhand smoke in the room and a different kind of secondhand smoke at the concert. And it was all we could do to pack up our stuff and to stumble down to the Continental breakfast to grab a cup of coffee. And I grabbed a cup and I went to pour the coffee. And what came out can only be described as inedible sludge. It wasn't coffee. I don't know what it was, but it was just awful. I tried taking a drink of it and I just had to spit it back out. It was just absolutely disgusting. And the staff didn't seem too concerned that they were serving swamp water. And so we just ended up leaving. And we just drove 3 hours in absolute silence. Like not a word, just sitting there, quiet, angry, irritable. And that's when I saw it, a beacon of hope in a dry and weary wasteland. I caught a glimpse of a sign out of the corner of my eye with the words, free coffee. And so all of a sudden I jumped up in my seat. I said, Mike, free coffee, where? Like there. And he grabs the steering wheel, I kid you not, going 70 miles per hour, he goes over four lanes of traffic into the off-ramp in order to get this free coffee. And so we got our free coffee and free cookies, by the way, which is pretty awesome. Our spirits were lifted and we drove the rest of the way home in a peaceful bliss, listening to the soothing sounds of Coldplay. Now, why am I telling you this story, right? It's kind of a ridiculous story. Well, the reason is because we're starting a new series called Signs. And the reason I wanted to start with this story is to illustrate what a sign is. Because a sign isn't just a bunch of words on a piece of wood or on some steel or something like that. No, a sign points to something else, right? The whole purpose of a sign is not itself like, hey, look at me, I'm a sign, aren't I beautiful? No, the whole purpose of a sign is to point your attention elsewhere, right? A sign can inspire hope, like free coffee. It can restrict freedom, right? No trespassing. It can provide instruction, you know, push or pull. It can give you direction, you know, next town, you know, however many kilometers away. But a sign never exists for its own sake. Well, in the Gospel of John, Jesus performs seven signs that reveal his identity, that point to who he is. And these signs are dramatic and evoke very divisive reactions from the crowd. And in each case, the message of the sign is not the miracle or the dramatic action itself. It's beyond that. It's what it signifies. And this isn't to say that the miracle doesn't matter, but it's saying if we want to know what's really going on, If we want to understand why Jesus did this and what he's getting at, we have to look beyond the sign, beyond the miracle, to the message, to Jesus himself. And if we look closely enough, we're met with a very startling revelation. Not only do the signs tell us something about who Jesus is, they also reveal a little bit of something about who we are. Because how we react, because we will react, reveals what's in our hearts. And in fact, the entire book of John is written so that we would believe in Jesus. In John chapter 20, 31, he comes right out and says it. He said, "But these are written so that you may continue to believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing in him, you will have life by the power of his name." And so today, we're going to take a look at the first two signs recorded in the book of John. And now, it's a little bit of a longer portion, but it's important that we take these signs together. John does that on purpose, and so it's important that we also do that as well. We're going to be taking a look at John chapter 2, and we're going to look at the first 25 verses. If you've got a Bible, you can follow along. If not, just close your eyes and just try to plant yourself in first century Israel and just experience these moments. So let's read John chapter 2 together. "The next day, there was a wedding celebration in the village of Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples were also invited to the celebration. The wine supply ran out during the festivities, so Jesus' mother told him, 'We have no more wine.' 'Dear woman, that is not our problem,' Jesus replied. 'My time has not yet come.' But his mother told the servants, 'Do whatever he tells you.' Standing nearby were six stone water jars used for Jewish ceremonial washing. Each would hold 20 to 30 gallons. Jesus told the servants, 'Fill the jars with water.' When the jars had been filled, he said, 'Now dip some out and take it to the master of ceremonies.' So the servants followed his instructions. When the master of ceremonies tasted the water that was now wine, not knowing where it had come from, though, of course, the servants knew, he called the bridegroom over. 'A host always serves the best wine first,' he said. 'Then, when everyone has had a lot to drink, he brings out the less expensive wine, but you have kept the best until now.' This miraculous sign at Cana in Galilee was the first time Jesus revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him. After the wedding, he went to Capernaum for a few days with his mother and brothers and the disciples." Now it moves to the next sign. "It was nearly time for the Jewish Passover celebration, so Jesus went to Jerusalem. In the temple area, he saw merchants selling cattle, sheep, and doves for sacrifices. He saw dealers at tables exchanging foreign money. Jesus made a whip from some ropes and chased them all out of the temple. He drove out the sheep and the cattle, scattered the money changers' coins over the floor, and turned over their tables. Then going over to the people who sold doves, he told them, 'Get these things out of here. Stop turning my father's house into a marketplace.' Then his disciples remembered this prophecy from the scriptures, 'Passion for God's house will consume me.' But the Jewish leaders demanded, 'What are you doing? If God gave you authority to do this, show us a miraculous sign to prove it.' 'All right,' Jesus replied, 'destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up.' 'What?' they exclaimed. 'It has taken 46 years to build this temple, and you can rebuild it in 3 days? But when Jesus said this temple, he meant his own body. After he was raised from the dead, the disciples remembered he said this, and they believed both scriptures and what Jesus had said. Because of the miraculous signs Jesus did in Jerusalem at the Passover celebration, many began to trust in him. But Jesus didn't trust them because he knew all about people. No one needed to tell him about human nature, for he knew what was in each person's heart." So we have two very dramatic and two very different signs. And John does something very puzzling here. And you may have, if you've read the Bible before, you may have wondered this yourself. He records the temple cleansing at the beginning of Jesus' ministry. While the synoptic gospels, that's what we call the other three gospels or accounts of Jesus' life, the synoptic gospels place the temple clearing on the week of Jesus' death on the cross. And so who is right here? Is it John or is it the synoptics? Well, it's a trick question. See, John is taking a little bit of chronological liberty here because he wants us to view Jesus' first sign and his last sign side by side. Because together they reveal who Jesus is in a very profound way. In a lot of ways, these two signs could not be any more different. One takes place at a wedding celebration, the other one at a temple. One, Jesus performs a miracle, the other one, he comes in and he just flips tables. Right? One is a celebration, the other is a rebuke. One is behind the scenes and unseen by most people, and the other one is a public outburst. But at the same time, they're also very similar. On both occasions, the signs seem to be completely lost on the immediate audience. People don't know what's going on. It's really the hindsight of the cross that brings the truth of these signs to the surface. Both are proclamations about his divinity, and both are about the new thing that God has unleashed on the world. So let's take a look at each of these signs and see what they reveal about who Jesus is, what God is doing, and where we fit in. So let's start with the new wine. Now, we should not skip over the fact that Jesus' first miracle was at a wedding celebration. This tells us something very important about the kingdom of heaven. Faith in Jesus isn't a solemn funeral dirge. It's not a life of misery. It's a celebratory existence. We have the good news. We have the resurrection. And so it's entirely fitting that Jesus' first miracle is turning water into wine. Now, during the feast, right, they ran out of wine. And this is a social embarrassment of epic proportion. In the first century, wedding feasts would go for days on end. And to run out of wine would mean that either the groom was a cheapskate or he was poor. And both would bring shame on his reputation. It was not a good start to a marriage. And so Mary comes to Jesus, and you know they could have been relatives, and she could have had compassion on them. And so Mary comes to Jesus and asks him to do something about it. Now, it's unlikely, since Jesus hasn't performed any signs up to this point, that she's asking Jesus to do the miraculous. She's probably leaning on Jesus as the eldest son to go and run an errand, to go and do something about this situation. And Jesus' response is hilarious because it completely catches us off guard. He responds, "Woman, that's not our problem." And now Jesus' response, "Woman," you need to understand, isn't as offensive as it would be to call your own mother that today. It's not the same tone as saying, "Okay, woman," right? It was used commonly in conversation with the female gender, and it meant no disrespect. But it was too formal and too removed and too distant to be used for your own mother. And so why would Jesus use that expression? I think it wasn't so much that Jesus forgot his manners, but he chose to distance himself from Mary to show us that no one gets an inside track to Jesus. No one has a leg up or standing or is closer to Jesus by birthright or by good works or anything like that. No one gets an inside track to Jesus. And Jesus goes on to say, look, it's not our problem. And he explains why. He said, my time or my hour or glory has not come. See, the Gospel of John when Jesus refers to his hour or time or glory, depending on what translation you have, he is speaking of his crucifixion. Now, of course, Mary didn't know that. And so there's two different levels of conversation happening here. One's natural, right? We've got a problem, we've run out of wine. And one's supernatural. Jesus is already looking at the kingdom of heaven and his ultimate sacrifice on the cross. But Jesus sees an incredible opportunity for a teachable moment here. He sees six stone jars of water that are used for Jewish purification rites. Now, according to the law, it was very important to remain clean, and there was all kinds of ceremonial washing and physical cleansing that came with a ritual washing was also considered to provide some spiritual cleansing as well. And so these stone jars were used specifically for that purpose. And Jesus tells the servants to fill them to the brim with water. And once they're filled, Jesus turns the water into wine. It doesn't say exactly when it happened, only that when they dipped it in and they brought it to the master of ceremonies, it was wine. And so Jesus takes the symbols of shame and turns them into a symbol of celebration. Well, hold up a sec. What do you mean a symbol of shame? You just said that these are used for purifying and washing. Well, it's a symbol of shame because it was never good enough. You had to constantly be washed. You had to constantly go back. It was a constant reminder of your inadequacy as a person. And so Jesus takes the symbols of inadequacy and shame, and he turns it into the symbol of abundance and celebration. Right? He in one dramatic moment, he completely changes the narrative. More than that, this is also a fulfillment of messianic prophecy. See, the Messiah was the one that Israel the one that Israel thought would come and restore the nation of Israel, which is true. That's what Jesus did, but he didn't do it the way that they expected that he would do. But in Isaiah 25, 6 to 8, it talks about the Messianic age. It says, in Jerusalem, the Lord of heaven's armies will spread a wonderful feast for all the people of the world. It will be a delicious banquet with clear, well-aged wine and choice meat. There he will remove the cloud of gloom, the shadow of death that hangs over the earth. He will swallow up death forever. So when a Jewish reader would read this account, right? Because that's what John did. He wrote so that we would continue to believe. And so when a Jewish believer would read this account, their mind would go to this passage in Isaiah or to ones like it and immediately realize that Jesus is saying he's the Messiah. Now, maybe for a Gentile or a Greek reader, there was an old myth about the god Dionysos. I can't say that. Let's see if I can say Dionysos, whatever. An ancient god would come to mind. And in the tale, there were three empty jars that would be sealed behind doors. And in the morning, they would open up the doors and the three jugs that were empty would now be filled with wine. And so to both the Jew and the Gentile, this was a sign of Jesus' divine status. See, Jesus wasn't limited by Jewish expectations. He wasn't limited by Greek myth, but he transcends both of them. And Jesus' miraculous sign holds the wedding feast of God in Revelation 19 with the hour of his crucifixion in tension. See, Jesus would bring about once for all purification on the cross. And that would make a way for the great wedding feast of God. And so the conversation, as the story moves on, the conversation between the groom and the master of ceremonies, again, is hilarious. The master of ceremonies comes up, and I imagine him being all chummy, you know, and he comes up to the groom and he throws his arm around him and says, a host always serves the best wine first. Then when everyone has had a lot to drink, he brings out the less expensive wine. But you have kept the best until now. And there's no response from the groom. His stunned silence is palpable. He has no idea what has happened. But the point is clear. The point is this: the new is far superior to the old. The new covenant that Jesus came to establish through his death is far greater than the old covenant made with Israel. And after this story, the narrative abruptly shifts to the last Passover, to Jesus' Passion Week in Jerusalem, and we find Jesus at the temple. And this is where Jesus proclaims the building of a new temple. As we mentioned earlier, this takes place during Jesus' Passion Week, the week leading up to his death. And what makes this sign so jarring is it doesn't seem to fit with what we would often describe as the character of Jesus. You know, when most of us picture Jesus, maybe it's he's sitting over a lake and there's crowds there and there's little children sitting on his lap. When most of us picture Jesus, we don't think of him with a homemade whip flipping tables, right? Clearly, there's more going on here. Some people have called this Jesus's temple tantrum, but that is so cheap. There's so much more that's going on here. You know what? So we have to ask ourselves, what made Jesus so furious? What made him so angry that he was led to do this? While there is no doubt that there is probably corrupt business practices like extortion taking place, and in the synoptics accounts, Jesus calls it a den of robbers. But that's only part of the reason. The real reason is much more simple than that. They had taken the court of the Gentiles, there were different courts where different people could worship, and they had taken the court where the Gentiles could come and worship God, and they turned it into a marketplace. They had turned the temple, the place of worship, into a for-profit business. Now, interestingly, in the first century, buildings were considered to have personal attributes. See, it was possible to bring shame on a house or a business, and in this particular case, shame on the temple. And by bringing shame on the temple, you would be bringing shame on God himself. But in this story, it's not the institution here that is offended. The priests aren't offended. It's Jesus. He cries out, stop making my Father's house a marketplace. Did you catch that? He says, my Father's house. And by saying that he is God's son, Jesus makes himself equal with God. And he's saying that this offense of setting up a market in a place of worship, this offense is actually against me. Now, it's also important to understand that there were different expectations that the Messiah would come and restore temple worship back to its former glory. There'd be a cleansing that would take place. And so it's not surprising that the Jewish leaders demanded of Jesus, like, what are you doing? Right? If God gave you the authority to do this, show us a miraculous sign to prove it. I mean, fair enough. If you're going to flip tables and chase people out of here, and you're saying that this is your Father's house, show us that you're the Messiah. Show us that you have the authority to do this by performing a miraculous sign. But just as with the wedding, Jesus talks at a different level than them. They're looking for a miracle. They're looking for a sign. But Jesus says this. He says, all right, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. And the leaders were absolutely incredulous. They said, look, it's taken 46 years to build this temple. Like, who, like, do you think you are? What kind of crazy nut are you? But we're told in the next verse that Jesus was referring to his body, not the physical temple, but that the physical temple would actually be replaced, fulfilled, if you'd rather, in him. that Jesus himself would be the new temple. I love what Edward Clink III, what a great name. I love what he writes. He says this, "The cleansing of the temple is the replacement of a system that was trading what it did not have, the true removal of sins, for what it should not want, personal profit." But through his hour of glorification, that's the cross, Jesus would fulfill the role of the Passover lamb. He would fulfill the role of the purification rites. He would fulfill the role of the sacrificial system. And ultimately, he would fulfill the role of the temple by being the only access to God's presence. And it's incredibly prophetic and beautiful that Jesus makes this bold declaration, not in the Holy of Holies where God's presence was believed to be, but in the common court of the Gentiles, to just show the availability, the free open access to God through Jesus. You know, it's also very damning that the Jewish leaders asked for a sign. Because you have to remember that Jesus performed many different signs, many different miracles throughout his public ministry, right? Remember, this is the last sign. John takes the first and the last and he puts them together. And so the Jewish religious leaders had seen Jesus perform signs. They had heard his teaching. And they were blinded to who he was. But here's the interesting thing. It wasn't Jesus' plan to convince them. It wasn't his plan to show them who he truly was. In fact, just the opposite. It was his plan to bring about his defeat. It was his plan to bring about his own defeat. He needed to ensure that they were angry enough, that they were offended enough, that either they would believe or they would kill him. And in killing him, bring about the victory of God. Remember, the signs of Jesus not only reveal who he is, but they also reveal who we are and what's in our hearts. So when you take these two signs together, what is the message? What is the message of these signs? Well, the message of these signs is clear. Jesus is the new that God has unleashed on the world. Jesus is the new thing, the new person that God is doing. Jesus brought the kingdom. Jesus brought the new creation. He is the new wine and the new temple. He is the one who purifies, and he alone is the way to God's eternal presence. In Hebrews 12, verse 2, it declares, "We do this by keeping our eyes on Jesus, the champion who initiates and perfects our faith. Because of the joy awaiting him, he endured the cross, disregarding its shame. Now he is seated in the place of honor beside God's throne." See, Jesus willingly became our shame. He was shamed at the temple and he was scorned on the cross, and yet he did it all for the joy set before him. And what was that joy? Well, we saw it in the first sign, the kingdom of heaven come to earth, the new creation, the wedding celebration of God. See, don't you see that through Jesus, you can leave behind your life of shame. You can leave behind the burden of shame and enter into the celebration of new life. Through Jesus, you have gone from being outcasts to having open access to God's presence. And this is what Paul is talking about in 2 Corinthians 5:17. And this passage just drips with this meaning. This means that anyone who belongs to Christ has become a new person. The old is gone and the new life has begun. So friends, I want to encourage you this morning. I plead with you to hear me out. If you are burdened with shame, Jesus invites you to the life that is truly life. Whether you're holding on to the shame of sin or experiencing shame imposed by religion, Jesus invites you into a relationship with him. He invites you to the table, to the wedding feast of God. And so, friends, I want to give you an opportunity, if you've never made a decision to accept the new life in Jesus, to follow him, to believe in him. That's why John wrote this book. That's why he recorded the signs of Jesus, so that we would believe. And if you would like to believe in Jesus, I invite you to say this prayer wherever you are with me. Dear Heavenly Father, I believe. I believe in Jesus, the Holy Son of God. I believe that he died and rose again to take my sin and take my shame and to invite me into new life. Jesus, I'm sorry for the times that I've sinned, that I've fallen short. And I ask for your forgiveness. I ask for you to cleanse me, to purify me, to make me new. In Jesus' name, amen.